This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the founder and the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement and the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. Today, I will give a very broad viewer discretion as advised due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing. Today, I am joined by Karen Hansen. Karen, welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast.
Thank you, Zachary. I'm happy to be here.
I am ecstatic for you to be here because this has been a long time in the coming. We've been talking about this, and then scheduling gets in the way and life gets in the way. And speaking of life, what a time. So I would love for you to begin, you know, letting us know who Karen is. I know this is a very broad topic, but feel free to introduce yourself to the audience. Walk us through, you know, a bit of your journey, what led you into, you know, doing the work you're doing now. Just give us, you know, feel free to ramble at this point. I think people by now are used to listening. So we are one of the only podcasts that allows the unfiltered and the unedited and just have that free-flowing conversation. There are some other podcasts that do so, but they still continuously edit. But this one's a little bit different. So feel free to ramble and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. So my name is Karen Hansen, and I am an advocate for childhood sexual abuse and domestic violence. My background, though, is that I am educated, and my profession, educated in interior design, and my profession is interior design. So professionally, that's my background, but my personal story led me toward the advocacy work, which I do love and am very passionate about. So we'll talk about that today and my journey and how I kind of came to do this work. But yeah, I feel like it's my life mission, and kind of my mantra is that I want to leave the world a better place than I found it. So it's not a short-term goal for me. It's kind of inherent in who I am and how I live my life. So I'm more than happy to ramble, that's for sure. But I think maybe the nerves are kicking in right at the beginning. So so Zachary, I'm going to have you jump back in and ask questions, and then I'll roll from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you gave me a list that you wanted to directly cover, and we'll kind of go by this, you know, we'll break it up, and then we'll have some like conversation, and then we'll break it up and have some conversation, because, you know, again, at this point, people are used to listening to me ramble, so I can ramble as well. But you are a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, and, you know, walk us through a little bit of that journey as much as you would like to. There's no pressure. And yeah, walk us through, you know, a little bit about that journey, and, you know, walk us through a little bit of your childhood, and then we'll kind of jump into college, and then, you know, some like other different topics that are very pertinent to talk about, especially right now.
Yes, I definitely am excited to be on the podcast, because I feel like so much of my story, even though this is going back decades, so much of it is relevant to what's happening in the world right now. And that's the reason I wanted to share specific things about my story with you today and with the audience, because I feel like there's, you know, we're we're kind of just losing our humanity. Everyone's kind of leaning one direction or the other. We're all being taught to hate each other. And I'm hopeful that through sharing my experiences, that I think a lot of people can relate to bits and pieces of my story. I'm hoping that it, people can kind of have a heart again and kind of remember that we are all in this like life journey together. So I'll start by just telling you a little bit about my childhood. My mother and father were married when I was born, and then they ended up getting divorced pretty soon after. So I grew up without a father in my life. My mother did get married when I was in second grade, and I inherited a stepfather. And without going into too much detail, although I'm happy to, but just to kind of give the Cliff Notes version of the story to begin with, by the time I was about 8 years old, my mother, my biological mother, and my stepfather began to groom, and I became a victim of childhood sexual abuse. It took me years, decades, really, to wrap my head around the fact that that's what it was. But once I understood the definition, once I understood the legal terminology, I realized that that is what my life experience was as a child. So that was at a young age. It went on for a few years. And when I went away to, like years later, I went away to college. And I'd gotten married at the age of 19, which in, I used to say it's to young people, like I don't recommend doing that. But if I'm giving myself some grace and I think through why I did that, I feel like it was really a form of escapism. So I think I was just trying to get out of that household, and I fell in love and was just, excited for what the possibilities could be outside of that household. So I got married and we moved away to Tallahassee in Florida, where I was going to Florida State University. I was going to go to Florida State University. I'd been accepted to their interior design program, and I'd been on a waiting list for a year. So it was, a pretty small program. It was prestigious to be accepted into the program, and I was super excited about it. And so we moved up to Tallahassee around May, and we were there for the summer to prepare to start school in August, the end of August. And I'd been married for about 2 years at that time. And it was a Saturday morning, and my husband and I woke up, and he looked over at me and he just said very bluntly, "I don't want to be married anymore." And although my mother had been divorced, I just remember thinking, like, "What do you mean you don't want to be married anymore? Like, that's an option." And so it really just caught me off guard. I was unprepared for that. And when he left, he left for that day, said he would be back in a week to get the rest of his things. So I went to a friend's house. I was crying and upset, and they said it was a couple of girls who lived in my neighborhood. They said, "We're going to go out tonight and we're going to get you drunk." So that was our college way of, like, dealing with this catastrophe that had just happened. So we went out, and I wasn't really a big drinker at the time. I had just turned 21. So I really wasn't, it just wasn't what I did on a regular basis. And that night I drank about two pitchers of beer by myself, which I'm only 5'2". So two pitchers of beer is a lot of alcohol at my size, probably for anyone. But anyway, we came home at the end of the night, and the girls insisted that one of the guys that was with us, that he walk me home. And At that time I was like, I'm fine. It's only, a few steps away. I don't need you to walk me home. And they insisted, it's late, you've been drinking, it's better to be safe than sorry. Let him walk you home. So this guy walked me home. I had not met him before. My friend had just started dating him. And when I got to my house, he followed me in. And to kind of make a long story short, he ended up raping me in my own bed. And I always say I did what any adult would do at that point. I curled up in the fetal position and I cried myself to sleep. And when I woke up the next morning, I just was kind of like hoping that was just a nightmare. Like, did that really happen? Who could I even tell? And I just kind of blocked it out, like it didn't even happen. And the next week, my husband came back to gather the rest of his things and he left. And a few weeks later, I started at Florida State. I kind of just buried that memory, that thought, that experience, and started Florida State, ended up starting the divorce proceedings. So here I was in a new town, new school. My husband has just left. I'm now on my own. So the stress level is just really high. And I ended up missing my period, didn't realize it, right away, just because I was so busy with everything else. And I was about 15 weeks when I finally realized, oh, I've missed my period. It was always kind of irregular anyway, and didn't really think twice about it until it just seemed really, I could tell something was wrong or not feeling right in my body. So I got a pregnancy test and it turned out that I was pregnant. So I ended up doing a paternity test once the baby was, well, actually, let me back up a second. I find out I'm pregnant and I go to my mother to tell her that I'm pregnant and I say, I'm going to get an abortion. And my mom's like, no, you're not. You weren't raised that way. You're not getting an abortion. And for someone who really never did what I was told to do, I for once did and didn't get an abortion. I was like, I don't know how I'm going to have a baby and go to school, but she was like, you'll figure it out. So, fast forward, I end up having the baby during spring break, and my divorce was finalized a week prior to that. So, I actually went into early labor from the stress. And during that time, while I was pregnant, I had a job and I was going to school, but I ended up being diagnosed with preeclampsia when I went in for one of my checkups with the OB. And for those of you who don't know, preeclampsia is high blood pressure that comes on during pregnancy or because of pregnancy. So the doctor said, you need to either quit your job or you need to quit school, or we're going to put you on bed rest in the hospital. We're going to admit you for the remainder of your pregnancy. So obviously that was not an option. So I quit my job. I kept going to school. I was living on student loans at the time. But with the baby coming, I could not, everything I had was going towards school and toward living expenses. And I really could not afford this baby. So I went to apply for financial aid and food stamps or anything that I could possibly get from state aid. And I didn't know anyone who'd ever done that before. I'd never been in that position before, but it was a desperate situation. So I tried to get financial assistance and I couldn't because even though I didn't have a job, I had no income. I had a car in my name. With a car in my name, they wouldn't give me financial assistance. So they said, if you sell your car, then we can give you money. And I was like, well, if I sell my car, I can't even get to the grocery store. I can't get to school. I have no way to get around. So they were like, well, we can't help you then, but we can give you food stamps. So I ended up getting food stamps, which covered cheese, bread, milk, eggs, and formula for the baby. And that's what we ended up living on. And I remember at the time just thinking to myself, this is where I am now, but this is not where I'm going to stay. And this government assistance that I'm getting, I will pay this back tenfold. And, to this day, I have. But it was really such a humiliating time in my life to be pregnant. I'm standing in a welfare line and, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know. I'm assuming they're going to help me, but to find out that they can't or they won't because I have a car, it was just like, it just seems so backwards. I didn't need a handout.
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The RealReal. The RealReal is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, "I found it on The RealReal." Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail? Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
I just needed a hand up, as they say. And so basically, I ended up with just the food stamps, which I was grateful for at the time, because, like I said, that is what was able to feed me and feed the baby. But it was just a really stressful time. And I remember meeting another girl who was standing in line with me. She was a young sorority girl from Florida State as well. She'd gotten pregnant from a boyfriend that she'd been with. When she got pregnant, her family disowned her. The boyfriend broke up with her. So there we were, the two of us standing in this line together, trying to get, financial assistance, and both of us ending up with food stamps. So I think one of the main reasons that I wanted to talk about that today is because, when you hear about the millions of people who are going to lose their SNAP benefits, it blows my mind to think that, A, that people are okay with that, that people are going to go hungry. I mean, in my case, I had no other option other than to get financial assistance. We would have gone without eating. And I just, there's such a dichotomy between, people who will say, well, you didn't have an abortion and that's so great. They kind of put you on a pedestal for that. But then they also look down on you when you get food stamps. And it's like, well, I couldn't afford to have this baby that I chose to have. I didn't get pregnant by choice. So it's just this like vicious circle where they look down on you for being a single mom. They praise you for being, the person who doesn't have an abortion. Then they look down on you for having food stamps. And it's just like, I don't know, it's just, it feels very sort of opposite extremes, like colliding. So I guess I'll pause there. That was a lot of information and let you jump back in.
No, you're perfectly fine. And I think you're painting a picture about the necessity that these programs continue to exist. And as we were talking about during our pre-interview, and just a little bit ago before we began recording, that my mom also got food stamps because there was a time that we really needed the assistance. I had a stepfather in the picture, however, he ended up losing his job He is an alcoholic and ended up losing his job. My mom was working essentially, it's quote unquote full time, but it was like part time pay. And I saw the struggle that she was doing. And I said, Mom, why don't you apply for food stamps? She's like, oh, I think I make too much. Because at that time, it was different like guidelines about what they had that you qualified for, you didn't qualify for. And at that time, Missouri was fairly, functioning, I should say. At least they were functioning a little bit better than they are now. We know that Missouri is literally going back ass backwards now, just like the rest of the country. But at that time, I'm in school. It's like my middle school year, and my mom gets on food stamps, and I will never forget the look on her face whenever they told her that she has been approved for food stamps. It's like a whole like. It was like a huge ass weight was just lifted off of her shoulders, and she was like trying to figure out how to, put my kid through school. I'm trying to figure out how to pay these bills, trying to figure out how to put food on the table because it's just too goddamn high. And she recognized that. And my stepfather did not work for many, many, many years after that. And, it was one of those times where nothing was good enough for him, essentially. And there's a lot that also kind of went into that a little bit too, because he ended up getting into a fight with like his boss over alcohol, and like I said, ended up losing his job, and then he had to have heart surgery, and it just led to like a whole like world of like different things at that point in time. And fast forward, my mom divorced him in 2018, and that was probably the best. I'm gonna be honest, I got drunk as hell the night that she got divorced. And I ended up riding a moose. And this is a real oh my God. Anybody who has heard this story, which is only a couple people that have actually heard this story, but I got really drunk that night and ended up like dry humping a moose, apparently. I don't remember it. I do not remember. It wasn't a real moose. Hold on. Hold up, let me backtrack a second. That it's not a real moose. It was a fake moose because it was at a moose lodge here in Kansas City. And I ended up triumphing a freaking moose. And I don't
Oh my
remember it.
gosh.
And then we get home and I remember falling out of the back of the car and I told my mom, fuck it, just leave me here.
Oh my God.
And then, fast forward, walking in, she calls Kev, or oops, I almost name dropped him. I almost name dropped him.
You caught it. You caught it.
She called my stepfather and she said, you need to come out and get your drunk ass son. He comes out, he has one leg and fuck, he's probably drunk himself. And then I proceed to the bathroom and I remember falling in the bathtub and laughing my ass off. Like, God damn, that it hurt. I remember that. My mom took a picture and uses it as blackmail. My partner
Oh
actually
my
has that
gosh.
picture. This is before I know. This was right after I met my partner. And it was right after, it was the same year. This was in November of 2018. I met Amelia in September of 2018. And this is right after. And I'll tell you what, I never drank another day after that. That
Yeah.
is, the next day I got sober, and I've been sober ever since. And that was probably the best choice for me because alcohol and me did some weird shit. It led to a lot of abuse. It led through a lot of things. If I hear like somebody try to open like a beer can or like a pop can, I like instantly triggers me because it reminds me of my stepfather and then all those times that I would go to the bar and I set my drink down one time at a bar and I'll never do that again because I ended up being roofied.
Oh my God.
I ended up not feeling very well, and I was like, okay. I looked over at my friend that I was with, and I said, I'm gonna leave because something happened to my drink. She was like, what happened to your drink? Nobody came over here. Nobody did this. I said, were you not paying fucking attention? But anyway, so ended up being roofied, ended up going home, ended up having to get my stomach pumped that night because it was really bad. I felt horrendous. So to anybody who's listening, please do not leave your drink unattended.
Yeah, definitely.
It is a breeding ground for people that are out there. And if you do leave it, do not drink it. Grab another one.
Yeah, it's so wild. Like that sounds so far-fetched that it you know, that people think that doesn't happen, but it
It
does.
does. It really, really does. And there was a point in time that back whenever I had just graduated high school and I was going through like EMT Academy here in on the Missouri side. And so I live in Kansas now, but I grew up in Missouri. And I was going through the EMT Academy. And I remember during my clinicals, I passed the class with flying colors. The clinicals was a little tricky for me because it kind of, I was sexually assaulted at 17 and I responded to a apartment. And whenever I tell you this apartment was the most putrid thing that I've ever smelled in my entire life. It was literally disgusting. It reeked so bad of cat piss and cat shit and alcohol. And you could tell that there was narcotics. And the woman that we came up on, she was brutally raped by a couple guys. And she was not coherent at all. She ended up becoming coherent whenever we were in the back of the ambulance and was very combative. Because we had to use Narcan. That's the first time I ever saw Narcan administered by somebody else beside myself. And then I became a harm reductionist because I learned a lot about harm reduction and about the use of Narcan. I'm a big supporter of Narcan. I think it should be readily available and completely free of charge, especially in the most vulnerable places. And I did see that some of the other they're working on getting like more Narcan vending machines across the country. I think it's incredible. I love Narcan. And it is a very, obviously Narcan does not overturn alcohol, but it does overturn narcotics. Sometimes you have to use one or two doses, sometimes you have to do three doses. But if somebody has to have three doses, they probably literally did overdose, unfortunately. Because there's Narcan cannot save everything, and it's also inactive during certain narcotics too. But if somebody has like fentanyl, like mine was, it will overturn it as best as possible.
Yeah,
But
I didn't even know what that was until I'm actually on the Palm Beach County Criminal Justice Commission, and we had a presentation where they were talking about making it just like you said, like almost vending machines, like you have defibrillators in public places, about having it readily available, you know, in case someone needs it in an emergency. But they were actually giving them away that day, and they were like, every like college student should have them, because you just don't know. And but it was that was, you know, I was definitely ignorant on that subject. I had no idea what that was or that it even existed.
I learned so much being on the ambulance that I did not realize beforehand. It really opened my eyes a lot. And then, to paint a picture, I'm no longer on the ambulance because I actually fell out of the back of the ambulance and
Oh my gosh.
fractured my ankle in the middle of a call on a very busy highway. So you can imagine I'm on the ambulance, but now I have to have an ambulance come and transport me. And
Oh my gosh.
I was like, what the hell? I cannot catch a break.
Yeah, I didn't see that
So
one coming.
no, I didn't at all. I fell in the back of the ambulance responding to a car wreck and then fractured my ankle. And well, I was no longer on the ambulance. Because I was like, yeah, no, fuck this. I am not doing this. Plus, I was really triggered. And, just before that car wreck was that rape case that I unfortunately had to write up on. And it was definitely a devastating moment because I was like, oh, this really is a huge problem in this community. This is really, really huge. My mom's also a survivor, and that's definitely, that weighs very heavy on me. But, with that said, you mentioned about like food stamps, you mentioned about, running into another woman that was in line as well. What did you see? Like walking into that office, what did you see? Like looking around, who did you see and what did you see? And I'll tell you why I'm asking that question here in a second.
I just remember walking in and feeling so scared, so overwhelmed. I mean, I was 21 years old. Like I said, I'd never I'd never had that experience or anything like it before. And at 21, you think you're an adult, but you really haven't had much life experience. And so just walking into a government space like that was overwhelming. I mean, I'd gotten a driver's license, but that was about the only thing I had done in a government building at that point. So I walked in and it was huge. And there were people everywhere. And I would say it felt like I was one of the youngest. I don't know that I was, but I just remember being so overwhelmed and not knowing where to go, just like kind of when you walk in the DMV. It was that same kind of stress, I guess, but then there was also just such a humiliation factor about being there. And, to be candid, in that room in particular, I was a minority. And when I got into the line, that's when I met this other girl because she happened to be standing behind me. So we just started talking and comparing stories. And I don't really remember much after that, other than just being so confused by having nothing and then being told that I couldn't get help because, like I said, that I had a car in my name. And by the way, the car, I owed more on the car than it was worth. So I was upside down on it, but they were like, well, sell your car and then we can help you. And I'm thinking, if I sell my car, I'm going to be even more in debt and I can't get to the grocery store, school, anything else. Like, this literally makes no sense. So anyway, that is.
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts, real gifts, thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The RealReal. The RealReal is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The RealReal. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail? Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Is my memory of that. And I want to just add, here I was in a college town. So, by the time I did end up getting WIC, there were WIC checks at the time and called food stamps. So the SNAP program didn't exist yet. But I remember, I would go to the grocery store to get formula and to get food. And, I'm standing in line with like college bros, like frat boys buying beer, and I'm buying formula with WIC checks. And if I could have been invisible in that time, I would have. It was so humiliating, but again, I didn't feel like I had another choice. I couldn't work while I was pregnant, so I was already behind financially. And then once I had the baby, I couldn't afford to put the baby in daycare and go to school and work. The funds were not there. So anyway, back to your question about what did that look like and feel like. It looked like any government building that you've ever been in. It was, glass, metal, hard surfaces, cold, and a lot of people. So that's my memory of that space.
Yeah, and oftentimes we hear, oh, people are just there for a handout. They're too lazy. They don't want to work. So, my rebuttal to that is you're essentially stating that children do not deserve to eat. Well, first of all, how pro-life of you? Second of all, you're saying that my mom as a disabled woman who literally physically cannot hold down a job, you are saying that she does not deserve to have food stamps. You're saying that she does not deserve to eat. You are saying she does not deserve to have her Medicaid because she's going through cancer. Because, oh, she's just being lazy and she can't hold down a job. She's literally going through fucking cancer. And I think about that. And then I also think about the other women and the other people that are also on these programs that, and you know, people are literally dying in the streets at the hands of violence, the hands of gun violence, domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking, sex trafficking. And our criminal justice systems would rather criminalize somebody like my mom versus help her. And it's the very real reality. And I saw what these systems have done to my mom. And it's turned me into this big time advocate, you know, even more than I already was. I'm going on my 17th year of advocacy. Next year is when I began. So I've seen a thing. I've seen a thing or two. I've lived it. I grew up in poverty, grew up around violence, grew up around alcohol. I saw my friends, you know, literally die in front of my eyes. Like, it's all transpired me to create this movement. And as a single mother, you know, at that, I say my mom was single because practically she was. But because, like I said, stepfather's literally there, literally married to her, but at the same time, did not help with the shit, did not do anything. She might as well have been a single mom. And she's still a single mom, still taking care of me. Even, you know, to this day, I'm 29 years old, but, you know, she helps me in different ways that nobody will ever understand. But people look down on single moms, you know, and they say, oh, you know, you just don't want to be married. In code, you just don't want to be barefoot and pregnant. As my co-founder Gwen said in her song, you know, Barefoot and Pregnant, which went viral during 2023 after the fall of Roe v. Wade. And I just think about that. And whenever you tell people about your childhood sexual abuse, you stated that they feel appalled and sympathetic. So whenever you share your story, what are some of those reactions? Because like you said, you know, they're appalled and they're sympathetic, but there's a difference between sympathy and empathy. Talk about that for a second.
So, there's so much in everything that you just said, when the fact that I am a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. People don't understand that statistically, when you are a victim or survivor of childhood sexual abuse, and just to clarify, for me, at this point in my journey, I consider myself a survivor. I feel like I was a victim before I was able to do the healing that I've done to become what I would refer to as a survivor. But when you are a victim or survivor of childhood sexual abuse, you are statistically more likely to become a victim of rape later in life and to become a victim of domestic violence. So those three things kind of go hand in hand. And it's interesting to me, now I do talk about being a survivor of childhood sexual assault. I wasn't always public about that. But when I became a victim of rape, and again, now I would use the word survivor in that scenario as well. But when I became a victim of rape and then got pregnant, people would look at me like, oh, you're just like some trashy, young pregnant girl by yourself. And it's like, not only did no one really asked, but I also had not come to terms with the fact that that was rape at the time. I thought it was my fault because I was drunk. So, later I'm a single mom. My child is, in kindergarten and in elementary school, and I'm surrounded by all of these families, all these like Girl Scout moms, and I had my child in a private school because, I sacrificed everything to keep them in a private school for their entire education. And, I'm surrounded by all of these people who I felt like were looking down on me because I was one of two single moms in the entire, class at, or like grade level in this school. And years later, when people found out that that child was actually a product of rape, it was like the tides turned. Like all of a sudden they were like, oh my gosh, that's so, brave of you. You're such a good person for not having an abortion. And I'm just like, it was, I don't want to say it wasn't even my decision. My mom said, you're not getting an abortion. I didn't get one. It was like a childlike decision, really. And I have no regrets about the fact that I didn't get an abortion, but I am such a strong advocate for the right to choose because I don't think that everyone is capable of, taking the road that I took, taking that, having that experience. It's a difficult road. And I have a lot of grit, I have a lot of determination, and I am very strong. They say what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I always hated that phrase, but it is true. And I don't think that people should be forced to have a baby if they're not ready to. It should be their decision to be able, to make choices for their own life that work for them. And especially if it's someone who's gotten pregnant from rape. And I just want to throw in a statistic quickly, but, of all of the women who get raped in the US, 5% of those will result in pregnancy. So that's about 33 to 34,000 women per year in the United States alone. I don't think people realize the magnitude of that. So here I am, if it were today in the state of Florida, I wouldn't even be able to get an abortion, even if I'd wanted to, because of the way the laws are written now, because we just voted on it exactly a year ago in the state of Florida. But I would have been forced to have the baby. And so, like I said, it was interesting that people glorify you for not having an abortion, then they look down on you for being a single mom. And with everything that's happening now with the SNAP benefits, I didn't even realize, I knew that this was coming. People have been talking about it for several weeks and months now that the SNAP benefits were going to end. But as much healing as I've done from the childhood sexual abuse, rape, all of those things, I'd kind of locked away the memory of the what it felt like to stand in that welfare line and to get food stamps. And having all of this come to light again because of these SNAP benefits, it was like a trigger that took me right back to that. So now I'm like just feeling really empathetic. And I think a lot of people don't understand, to your point, what the difference is between being sympathetic and empathetic. But sympathetic is like, oh, I can rationalize and understand why someone might be sad or feel a certain way. But empathy is like when you physically feel what someone else is feeling, like you're in the emotion with them. And watching all of this happen in this country, hearing about people losing this financial assistance, this literal life-saving financial assistance, is gut-wrenching to me because, like I said, I just think back to being 21 years old, having this baby that I had not planned on having, and then just being petrified about how I was going to feed myself and this child. And to know that statistically these days, that's still happening. I'm not the only one that that happened to. I'm not the only one with that story. Now I'm in my 50s and I can look back. I'm not in that situation, but I feel like I'm speaking out on behalf of that 21-year-old version of myself and of all of those kids, those girls who are going through that now. So anyway, that's why I just feel like really passionate about this subject at this time. And I just feel like I want to shed light on the fact that people are not necessarily in this situation because they want to be. Life happens, like with what happened with your family, you know, life happens, circumstances happen, one thing leads to another. And all of a sudden, you're in a situation that you never expected to be in, and you've got to figure it out. You got to just make it happen. So, anyway, that's kind of my take on the whole subject.
Whenever I think of a systematic failure, and we know that these systems are really completely beyond fucked, but I think about the Adriana Smith case. For those of you who do not know, Adriana Smith was a woman from Georgia and was the focus of a medical ethics controversy. Following a medical emergency in February of 2025, Smith was declared brain dead. But continuing fetal cardiac activity was detected. According to the family, the hospital stated that ending Smith's life support would violate Georgia's abortion law, also known as the Life Act, which essentially restricted abortion once a fetal heartbeat is detected. In practice, a 6-week abortion ban, with exceptions in cases in which a police report for incest or rape has been filed, and for later abortions where the fetal abnormalities are life-threatening risk to the mother. This was passed in 2019. The law cannot be enforced until the 2022 ruling in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, which overturned Roe v. Wade. She was a 30-year-old Black woman who worked as a nurse and lived in Atlanta, Georgia. Was seen at Northside Hospital in February of 2025 after experiencing headaches. She was 9 weeks pregnant at the time. After Smith was given medication, she was released from the hospital. In the morning, her boyfriend called 911 after he woke up to Smith's gasp for air. After being taken to Emory University Hospital, which is in Atlanta, Georgia, she was declared brain dead after blood clots were found in her brain. In mid-May, Smith's mother, April Newkirk, disclosed to local news organizations that Smith's body had been on life support for 3 months to let the fetus grow enough to be delivered without giving the family a say in the matter. Newkirk said that she was told that the hospital's decision to keep Smith alive was required under Georgia's anti-abortion law because of the detection of fetal cardiac activity. On June 15th, Smith's family commemorated her 31st birthday at a somber private church service with abortion rights groups. 2 days later, the family announced the premature birth of a baby son named Chance, who weighed 1 pound, 13 ounces through an emergency cesarean section, aka C-section, earlier that week. Since Chance was born at just 6 months of gestation, his birth is classified by the World Health Organization as extremely preterm. 4 days later, his mother, Adriana Smith, was taken off life support. A funeral was held in that month. Whenever I think about this case, it literally shatters what's left of my heart. And this case and Adriana's life mattered.
Yeah, and if you can imagine being her family member, you know, like witnessing this, I mean, it was a really hard case to hear about and read about. And it's just such an extreme case, but that's where we are right
I
now.
think about this, and I think about all the other Adriana Smiths. I think about maternal health and how incredibly lax this country is whenever it comes to maternal health, especially marginalized women.
Yeah, exactly.
I think about that, and I can't help but feel that we're just going entirely backwards. We are one of the richest countries with some of the absolute poorest systems and the poorest communities within those systems, where somebody for a marijuana charge gets life in prison while a serial rapist runs around our communities. There's a problem. There is a direct problem. There's a very distinct problem, and it's the system working exactly how it was designed.
Exactly.
Now, shifting gears a little bit, you quit your job to continue going to school, student loans, which are predatory in itself,
Yes.
and are absolutely wow. We again, it's 2025. You would think that school would be cheaper or there'd be more scholarships, but in actuality, especially with the direct attacks on the Department of Education, we're seeing the opposite. We're seeing the exact opposite, and more people are dropping out of school. There is a most recent report that came out that students are automatically being flunked because the teachers and the educators feel that they are using AI to write their papers, even though they actually are not. But more students are dropping out of school and more students are being flunked because the teachers feel, and the educators, college professors, feel that students are using AI. And AI is deeply detrimental. Literally, I think it was like a couple weeks ago, there was a story that broke about, and I'll give another trigger warning, right, with what I'm about to say. So viewer discretion is advised, trigger warning, content warning, right before I say what I'm about to say. I'm gonna let that kind of sit for a second. There was a professor, I think she's a college professor from the UK, I believe, and discovered that Google AI was allowing people to create videos on how to murder women and uploading them to YouTube.
Wow.
So I discovered that, and whenever I tell you, my mouth literally dropped. It literally dropped. Because I'm not, I, but to say that I'm surprised, it's like one of those shock moments, but then you kind of think about it and you're like, is it really that shocking considering the state of where we are? Well, I mean, yeah, kind of still. Because I just didn't realize how bad it actually was, but that kind of opened my eyes a lot more. And then I dug a little bit more and actually watched one of the videos, and I never want to see it again. But I, yeah, that's where we are. But you dropped out or you quit the job to continue school. Where were you working at that time? Like, what were you doing?
When I was in school, this is so random. I just went everywhere to get a job, anywhere I could find one, and I ended up at Dillard's, which is like a department store. And I worked in the lingerie department, so it was pretty comical because by the end, when I had to quit working, I was probably about 6 months pregnant. So I'm like this giant pregnant girl working in the lingerie department, like measuring women for bras. Speaking of being scarred for life, I never want to have that experience again. But anyway, yeah. So I quit my job in the lingerie department. And but yeah, I'd always been a really hard worker, like when I first started, I went to community college to begin with and had four jobs at the time. So I'd always been a really hard worker. And so to be told that I had to quit working, I was just like, what? Like it made no sense to me. And those student loans that we were talking about, I think I borrowed like $20,000 or $21,000 at the time. And again, this is like 1995. I ended up paying back those loans when my oldest child graduated from college. We both paid our loans back at the same time. And by that point, I'd paid over $40,000 to pay that off. So I ended up paying more in interest than I actually borrowed. So yeah, to say the system is a little messed up, that's for sure. And again, to just restate the impact of, having a child at that age, one that you're not planning for, the financial impact of that and how that completely changes your life, So, yeah, definitely sent me down a path that I had not planned or expected. And yeah, I don't think anyone grows up thinking, oh, I want to, be in debt, or I want to be on food stamps. I want to live on welfare. I don't think most people have that plan. I'm sure your mom didn't. I know I didn't.
No.
And then here we all are,
And fast forward, you graduated from college and 2 decades later, you have a trans child. Now, this is a part where I know it's going to get a little emotional because I know it's going to. But I would love for you to walk us through that journey for you from a mother's perspective.
Yeah, I my child and I were always very close, and I used to say that, we grew up together, which I know from a true like parenting perspective, that's probably not ideal. You want to have an adult raising a child. You don't want two kids raising each other, but I had a really great child, and I feel very fortunate. So this kind of goes back to the dichotomy that I was talking about before. People find out that you're a single mom, they look down on you. They find out you didn't have an abortion, they think you're great. Then you raise this child on your own, they find out that the child is a product of rape. They think that you're a hero for having gone through with the pregnancy and raising the child. And then going full circle in college, my child came out as part of the LGBT community, and then a couple of years later became part of the trans community. And it is emotional because I look around at how this country has begun to treat this 1% of the population, and it's not just 1% of the US population, it's 1% of the world is considers themselves trans. And to watch and hear the hatred, it is heart-wrenching. And I even in my friend group, I had a friend in the beginning of our friendship, I will say, who said, just kind of blurted out a comment and said, I think being trans, is a mental problem. And I just remember feeling like she had just stabbed me in the heart when she said that, because yeah, at the end of the day, we all have health, mental health issues to some degree. But to say something like that as a blanket statement was really hurtful. And I ended up talking to her about it later, one-on-one, and just saying, how hurtful that was. And I just feel like people blurt things out. They make ridiculous comments like, that it's about men dressing up in women's clothes and to go into the bathrooms, and my response to that is like, really? Do you see that often? Is that a big problem where you are? Because I actually haven't seen that. And the I feel like having a trans child, honestly, has been a gift, one that, again, I never saw coming. But the exposure that I've had to the LGBT community, and I'll backtrack and say this, I'm a designer, so stereotypically speaking, I've always had a lot of gay friends, but I didn't know any trans people, until my child entered that community. And it's been such a pleasure. That maybe that's not the right word, but it's been heartwarming to get to know people in the trans community and to listen to their stories and to find out where they've been and how they've gotten to where they are. And I just it The amount of hatred toward this community is staggering to me because they are some of the kindest and most empathetic people that I have met. And I mean, really would not want to harm anyone. They're out there just living their lives just like everybody else, getting up every day and going to work and feeding the dog and doing their thing. And all of a sudden, here they are, the target of a nation and of the world. And I'm just thinking, like, how many of them do you even know? And if you knew them, you wouldn't be spewing this hatred. You would be standing up for them. You would be right by their side. Like, it just, it's heart-wrenching to me. I don't understand it as a parent. I fear for my child's safety right now. And I feel like this community is so brave. Like, I'm so proud of the child that I have. I'm so proud that they are who they are, even with all of these bullies and ignorant people, speaking out against them. I'm personally, like, not just my child, but I'm so proud of the trans community and how they are holding their heads high and standing up for who they are and what they believe in and the amount of love that they show, even to those who look down on them, speak poorly about them, are working hard to pass legislation against them. I just, where is the humanity anymore? That's really kind of the overarching, phrase for me right now. Like, where is the humanity? Where we are going backwards in time with racism, with sexism, with homophobia. I remember the year that gay marriage was legalized. I was so overwhelmed. I was driving down the road and I heard it on the radio and I pulled over and just started sobbing because I just thought, thank God, like, finally, like, my child, if they so choose, has the right to do this just like everyone else does. And now it'll be easier. Now things will be easier for them. Now they will be seen as an equal. This is just the beginning with legalized marriage for everyone. It's just the beginning. Things will only get better from here. And now, fast forward 10 years later, here we are. And I'm just like, it's, I don't know. You know what? I'll say this. A lot of young people are choosing to not have kids these days. And I don't blame them because I'm just, like, amazed with the amount of hatred that is happening across the world right now. I don't know how we got to where we are, but I just wish that people could, like, pull themselves out of the news headlines for half a second and just look around at the people around them. And back to the trans community specifically, just remember that these are human beings. These are someone's child. These are someone's sibling. This is someone's grandkid. Like, they're paying taxes, they're working hard, they're contributing. And especially in America, like, at the end of the day, if something bad were to happen in America, like, those are your neighbors. Those would be some of the first people out to help you. So why? I'm borderline speechless at the treatment. I just don't understand it at all. I can't wrap my head around it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I want to add, first of all, thank you for sharing that deeply sensitive part of your story, because I know that's not the easiest part to share. You're None of it is easy to share, but I've connected. You talk about the trans community, and I've connected with the family of Sam Nordquist. Now, back in February, there was a case that broke headlines. Sam Nordquist is from Minnesota, and he was a trans man that left home in Minnesota last fall, and he traveled 1,000 miles to be with a woman he'd fallen in love with online. This is from an NBC article, and I remember reading this article. He ended up imprisoned in a cut-rate hotel in upstate New York, suffering unspeakable horrors before he was brutally murdered. A gang of seven people,
My
including the
God.
woman for whom he'd trekked across the country, had been charged with murder, accused of torturing and humiliating the 23-year-old transgender Black man in the hotel room for weeks before eventually killing him. The only people who called police were Nordquist's mother and sister back home, who pleaded for authorities to check in on him when he stopped responding to the messages. But Nordquist's body had already been dumped, wrapped in plastic bags in an empty field. Even though arrests have been made, first-degree murder charges have been filed, and the victim laid to rest, this case remains an incomprehensible display of human malice. Online posts told the story of a happy couple, but Nordquist's friends and families were increasingly concerned when he didn't return their messages. I will be bringing the sister and the mother on to talk about Sam for the podcast. Whenever I hear this story, my mind goes in a million and a half different directions because I think back to learning about the story of Matthew Shepard. And back in 2016, kind of a shameless plug for a second. I hate talking about myself, but kind of a shameless plug. Back in 2016, me and my mom traveled to Denver, Colorado. And I've shared this story on the podcast before, but I'll share it again because it's deeply important. Traveled to Denver, Colorado, and I accepted the Spirit of Matthew Award from the Matthew Shepard Foundation. And for those of you who do not know, Matthew Shepard was a 21-year-old gay student that was brutally murdered in Laramie, Wyoming, or he was brutally beaten and left for dead. It was around Halloween time. People thought that he was a Halloween prop until the next morning, whenever they realized he was an actual human being, and he died several days after. Which actually prompted a national outcry to recognize LGBTQ hate crimes in America. And the Matthew Shepard and Byrd Act passed Congress and was signed 16 years ago as of last month. Now, I can't tell you how it felt being on that stage, knowing who was in the room. Matthew Shepard's mom and Matthew Shepard's father, his brother, and the whole foundation team was there. And that's also the same day that I met Sean Hayes, aka Just Jack, from Will and Grace. Now, that was like a full circle moment because I watched Sean Hayes on TV, saw him on social media, saw him, in commercials. And for him to come up and talk to me, and I had a picture with him. For him to come up and talk to me and say, "Your story inspired me." I'm like, "My story inspired you." Like, I haven't been watching you on TV for years. It's like that's it's just that full circle moment. And that's like that joy moment. And it's like nothing else mattered when you step foot outside. And me and my mom go down to Chili's. And, like I said, it's Denver, Colorado. And we see, couples walking down the street holding hands. And it's like, wow, this is a whole, like, 360 moment. It's like, okay, maybe we are in good hands. And then I hear stories like Sam, and I hear stories of, Black trans women being murdered at astronomical rates. We had one here in Kansas City by the name of Brooklyn Lindsay. It devastated me. That story literally shattered my heart. And then learn about the Latina trans woman that was murdered a couple years before, or a couple months before. And just hearing about that, it's so devastating. But we'll be sharing more about Sam Nordquist in months to come because I'm going to do a very deep, thorough analysis on the Sam Nordquist story because there's a lot that goes into it. There's a lot about it. There's a lot that went into it. So I'll be talking about it quite a bit. So stay tuned for that. But you know, with all of this to say, you know, Karen, I want to say thank you for coming on the podcast. And we're not done just yet. There's a couple more things that I wanted to talk about. So today, you're an advocate for victims and survivors through legislation, speaking engagements, autobiography, you know, paid back government food assistance tenfold in taxes, paid off student loans, same year that your oldest child paid off theirs 24 years later. Your youngest child stocked food donations at Boca Helping Hands on November 1st, which, you know, the day the SNAP benefits ran out, which is a full circle moment. Today is November 2nd, so this is like literally as of yesterday. But walk us through what you're doing today. You know, like you said, advocate for survivors and victims through legislation, speaking engagements, and autobiography. So walk us through what you're doing today.
Yeah, so like you said, yesterday it was definitely a full circle moment. My oldest son, he's a senior in high school. He's working to get community service hours and he's waited until the last minute to do that. But it ended up being kind of interesting because he signed up for a local food bank and there were a lot of delays in, getting his application in and all of that. And the full circle moment was, yes, yesterday was November 1st, and it was his first day volunteering and getting community service. And he said that the food bank was packed, so packed that they ran out of food. And like I said, all of that just kind of came, rushing back for me, but I was just so grateful that my child was one of the people who was there to help facilitate that and to pay it forward. So, yeah, it was definitely like a proud moment. But just in terms of advocacy, I really am just doing as much as I can wherever I can. So, as I said before, I'm on the Palm Beach County Criminal Justice Commission. I was nominated by the now state attorney for Palm Beach County to be on that commission, and really am very proud to be not just on the commission, but also part of the executive committee. So we are working toward education and awareness about sexual assault, domestic violence. I'm currently working to get another rape crisis center in Palm Beach County. We have one at the moment for 1.5 million residents, which is staggering. So I'm hoping that within the next couple of years that will be in existence. I'm also working on getting some legislation in the state of Florida for victims' rights, and I have about a 50% success rate, which is not great, but it's better than zero on legislation. So I'd been working on a bill to get anonymity for victims of sexual assault, and the Florida legislature did not pass that 2 years in a row. So that was very disappointing, but I was able to help get a law passed called Serena's Law on behalf of a close friend of mine, which closed a loophole for basically sexual predators who were able to volunteer and be around children, even though they had been charged with sexual assault against children. So, anyway, I'm working on another piece of legislation at the moment, which is an anti-defamation piece of legislation so that victims are able to speak out without fear of being sued by their assailant. So hopefully that will make it to the House floor this year. We'll see. And hopefully it will pass. It's already passed in other states. So we'll see what happens there. But yeah, just doing lots of speaking engagements. Have another one this week at FAU, which is Florida Atlantic University, speaking to pre-med students on the subject of human trafficking and sexual assault, domestic violence. So that's the fifth year that I've done that speaking engagement. And yep, just looking forward to what else I can do to advocate for victims and for survivors and keeping up with my own therapy weekly on the side in order to, do all of that work. So that's what I'm doing at the moment.
And I'm grateful for your advocacy work because I think it's going to lead to a lot of, a lot of lives being saved too. And I always say that anytime somebody brings forth legislation, I think it's always so great to see the progress of everything, as it transpires from writing that legislation to talking about it to seeing it passed, et cetera. I passed a bill or I passed legislation in Kansas City to bar licensed professionals from enacting in conversion therapy in November of 2019. I remember, testifying before the almost said testifying before the Supreme Court, which is kind of coincidental considering the Supreme Court is hearing up arguments about conversion therapy right now.
Exactly. Yep.
But being a survivor of conversion therapy for 2.5 years, I remember sitting in the room and there's a lot of articles that came out about that time, around that time, that me and my mom were also featured in. My mom was right beside my side, as always. Full disclosure, I was not forced into conversion therapy by my parents, but society told me I needed to change myself. So I enacted in conversion therapy. And little did I know what was going to happen, I never would have done it. Now, society has a problem. Society has a major, major problem. We all know that. But is there anything else you wanted to share with our listeners today?
No, I just, I mean, on that point with the conversion therapy, I just want to say, like, why is it so upsetting to people that someone is gay or is trans or is a minority? Or, like, I just can't wrap my head around the hatred, the disgust, the prejudice. It just makes no sense to me. When be glad that people love someone else, instead of trying to tell them who they should love and how they should love them, just let them be who they are. And if they're not infringing on your rights, then keep moving, keep doing your thing, And in terms of advocacy, I just want to say, I know everyone is not going to be an advocate for sexual assault or domestic violence, but I just feel like if everyone picked one subject that was important to them, whether it's animal rights or human rights, equal rights, civil rights, whatever it is, if everyone just picked one thing and did something to contribute, something to give back in a way that, in a subject that's meaningful to them, the world would be a better place. And I just want to say, like, I guess kind of in closing, just focus on love instead of on hate, and really just try to put yourself in someone else's shoes and see if we can turn this ship around. Seems like a big task, but.
Yeah, it seems like a big task, but whenever you think about it, it's very simple because all it takes is one person to show the compassion and show that love. And that one person could be the president of the United States. However, he has chosen not to do so.
Yeah, it's going
And
to start somewhere. So it might as well be with all of us, doing our part. So.
yeah, absolutely. Kieran, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I cannot say thank you enough for being open and sharing your voice. And to anybody out there who is listening, Karen, where can they find you on social media?
So they can find me on Instagram under Wren Hansen, which is WREN underscore HANSEN underscore. or they can also go to my website, which is thecollectiveprojects, plural, .com, thecollectiveprojects.com, and they can read a little more about my story and about the work that I'm doing. So thank you so much, Zachary. I really appreciate you taking the time to hear my story and to share it with your listeners. And hopefully it was valuable information for someone today. And hopefully it, helps to move the needle in a positive direction.
Absolutely. Kieran, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You take good care of yourself, okay? All
Thank you so much. You too.
right, thank you.